Have you ever walked into a store and bought one bottle or one can of beer? This hour, we'll hear why one Iowa community is considering banning the sale of single-serving beer. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, questions about an anti-bullying conference that supposedly provided students with some controversial information, a first-of-its-kind UI study that shows kids with hearing loss benefit from early intervention, a conversation with a presidential candidate you've probably never heard of, and two views of the 2016 race from opposite ends of the political spectrum. Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we heard in our news this week that an Iowa legislative panel is planning a hearing on an anti-bullying conference. And supposedly this conference had provided some students with some controversial information. Here to fill us in, Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio Statehouse correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
So who is calling for the hearing and why?
Well, Representative Bobby Kaufman is chair of the Iowa House Oversight Committee. He's been very proactive in his new position chairing that committee. He held a number of hearings on the problems with the new prison, and now he is calling for this. There's quite a bit of controversy or a number of complaints about the governor's LGBTQ conference last year. It is billed as a conference on bullying, harassment, suicide prevention, and homelessness. But there was some graphic information presented that some people found objectionable. Representative Kaufman says while this is conference is sponsored by the Iowa Safe Schools Group, Representative Kaufman says some tax dollars are involved, and he doesn't think tax dollars should be spent on what he calls obscene material.
Mm-hmm. So this is a conference, and even though it's named, the governor's name is in the title, the governor is not part of the conference?
That's right. It's called the Governor's Conference on LGBTQ Youth, I believe is how is the full name. But it goes back to Governor Vilsack's years in office, a Democratic governor, and that's when it was named the Governor's Conference. And as I understand it, Governor Branstad did not withdraw that name of Governor's Conference when he took office.
Mm-hmm. So some of the charges here have to do with are of a sexual nature, and the response to this criticism is what?
Oh, well, the Safe Schools folks are not timid in responding to these complaints. The director of Iowa Safe Schools Group called it gay bashing and criticized House Republicans for not passing legislation to protect gay and lesbian youth. And so that's where it stands right now. I'm sure that we'll hear pros and cons at the hearing coming up.
Mm-hmm. So the hearing, is it slated for a specific date?
I think it's November 18th.
Mm-hmm. With the governor's name on it, any response or input from the governor on this so far?
No, I'm not aware. I reached out to them after this happened, but actually I was just simply not informed about the origins of the conference and the fact that it's privately funded, it's privately managed. There have been complaints from some school districts, even a call to prevent students from going to the conference. However, that would be a hard thing to pull off. It's, you know, it's basically in Iowa's public schools, these are, school clubs for gay and lesbian students. So it would be hard for a school district to come in and in effect, they would be subject to criticism for discriminating against a club, I would think.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll follow this story. Iowa Public Radio Statehouse correspondent Joyce Russell, thank you.
Okay.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Fridays, we like to have quicker conversations about some of the news we didn't get to otherwise during the week in our talk shows. Now on to a first-of-its-kind study, a University of Iowa study that shows kids with hearing loss benefit from early intervention. Joining us to tell us about it, someone who's been very involved in this study, Beth Walker, assistant professor in the University of Iowa's Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders. Hello, Beth.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
Tell us what this study looked at.
Well, this was a multi-center longitudinal study at the University of Iowa, Boys Town National Research Hospital, and University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And we recruited 317 children who were hard of hearing and 117 children with normal hearing as a control group. And we were really interested in documenting what are the speech, language, auditory, academic, social skill outcomes for these kids. And also, we wanted to contact their service providers and find out what kind of services they were getting from audiologists, early interventionists, really just trying to document what kinds of outcomes do these kids have, and if, once they've been identified with hearing loss, are they getting the intervention that they need?
Mm-hmm. So what did you find? The main finding was what people suspected but hadn't really nailed down with this kind of data, that you've got to get to these kids early?
Yep. So we really were the first research study to follow this generation of children that have a bilateral mild to severe hearing loss. So we call those kids children who are hard of hearing. And we already did know that early identification and intervention for hearing loss are important, but our real contribution is that we found evidence that there are certain factors, we call them malleable factors, that impact language development. And these would be things that parents and educators and audiologists have the power to influence in intervention. So, for example, we found that the quality of the child's hearing aid fitting had a positive impact on outcomes. So hearing aids can vary in how much audibility, amplification they provide. And children who had better fit hearing aids had better outcomes than children who are under-amplified. And we also found that children in the study varied in how much they wore the hearing aids. So we had some kids that wore the hearing aids all the time, and we had some kids that only wore them part of the day, like at school, and then we had some kids that didn't had hearing aids and didn't wear them at all. And this really had an impact on outcomes. The kids who wore the hearing aids during all waking hours had much better outcomes than the children who were less consistent users.
We wanted to listen to a little bit of audio to demonstrate the difference in speaking of a child who is hard of hearing. You know about this audio. We're going to hear this child at the age of 3, and then after that at the age of 7 years old. First at 3 years old, this is reciting some of the Pledge of Allegiance, and this this child is hard of hearing?
Yes, she was. She had a moderate hearing loss.
Okay, this is at the age of 3, the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the day United States of America and to the republic to which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
A little hard to make out there, a 3-year-old voice for sure.
Yes.
But then 4 years later at the age of 7, what has happened in the intervening time is there's a consistent use of hearing aids?
Yep. She was one of our users that she had. Her parents made sure she wore those hearing aids all the time. And the parents also got very involved in how the hearing aids were fit and made sure that she was receiving appropriate amplification from the hearing aids.
Okay, here's that same child 4 years later, same Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I'll say a beautiful, crystal clear recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance. So that really makes it very clear, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I'd like to add, she's in first grade, and that child is doing great in school. She's keeping up with her peers and really have had excellent outcomes.
Okay. So you've told us about the study and the findings. What are the implications here? I can think of one is that we've got to make sure we reduce the stigma attached to possibly wearing a hearing aid as a child, which is a hard thing to do.
That is. That's really, you're right, Ben. It is hard. There is a stigma attached to wearing hearing aids for children and for adults. And it's also really hard, I mean, if you think about if toddlers, it's hard to keep those. They don't even want to wear their socks some days, so they also don't want to wear their hearing aids. And so it's just important for parents to be persistent and keep those hearing aids on. We recognize that it's a struggle. Some of the implications are it does give great additional evidence to what we already knew, that we need to continue to support early hearing detection and intervention programs around the country. And I think the findings also have implications for pediatricians, because pediatricians and family practice doctors may be the first people to see these children after they fail the newborn hearing screen. And once the child fails a screen, the results get conveyed to the parents and to the child's physician, but really failing the hearing screen is just the first step. We also need to get hearing loss confirmed and find out what the severity of it is. And then we need to get those hearing aids fit as soon as possible. And these steps can take place by the time the child's even 3 months old. But we still have babies that are falling through the cracks. That's another thing that we found in the study, that some kids had delays after they failed the newborn hearing screen.
Right, right.
And they don't get the services. So
you may not realize it, but of course, even if a baby is babbling, its language development is working, is increasing.
Exactly. And so what some of the things with these children who are hard of hearing is that you may see them responding to sound because they don't have a complete hearing loss. They're not deaf. But that doesn't mean they have the access to speech that they need to develop language.
Beth, quickly before we go, maybe parents of babies out there right now wondering, what are the early signs of a possible hearing problem in a baby? What should you look for quickly?
Currently, almost all babies in Iowa, all babies are getting screened for hearing loss. And across the country, 97% of infants get screened for hearing loss at birth in the hospitals. But if your child, there is just passing a newborn hearing screen doesn't mean that you're not at risk for having hearing loss later on. And so some warning signs, red flags, may be delays in babbling development. So you may have a child who is not babbling around 6 to 7 months of age, or only babbles very restricted repertoire, maybe just one consonant sound, ba, 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 or ma, ma, ma. And then further on, as they get older, you may see delays. We see specific delays in their ability to use grammatical markers that are important for the English language. So things like plurals, like cats, or past tense, he walked to the store. So these little morphological markers get dropped because they're not very loud and they're very high-pitched sounds. And so those may be, if children are deleting or not including those sounds in their language, that can be a warning sign as well.
Okay, we have to go. Thank you, okay. Beth Walker, assistant professor in the University of Iowa Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders. A first-of-its-kind study that discovered many hard-of-hearing children who receive optimal early services are able to catch up or significantly close the gaps with their hearing peers. It's a study's findings that were published online this week in the the November-December issue of the journal Ear and Hearing. Beth Walker, thanks again.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on the day before our Halloween weekend. And by the way, having a bit of fun on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page right now, if you'd like to have a look at me in my Halloween costume, go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Don't worry, it's not scary. It's a bit of a puzzle. My Halloween costume on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Have you ever gone into a store to purchase just one can or bottle of beer? Well, some community leaders in Sioux City say the community there should consider prohibiting sales of certain single-serve beer for off-site consumption. To learn why, we're going to turn to Kirby Kaufman, Sioux City Journal reporter. Hi, Kirby.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. So, what is the concern there? Why do some think it's a good idea to at least talk about a ban on one can or one bottle of beer?
Well, a concern is that, especially in downtown Sioux City, where there's a lot of public intoxication, that these gentlemen and women that are on the streets can panhandle and easily cobble together a couple bucks to walk to a convenience store or a gas station and get these single-serving cans or bottles of beer that can be up to 12% proof. And, they'll take a bottle, go behind an alley, and they'll get drunk, and that's kind of where the problem starts.
Mm-hmm. I understand that this idea was brought up by a Native American activist and some local law enforcement officials.
Well, it started in September, where a public forum drew about 50 people, city officials, nonprofits, homeless shelters, all got together and had a conversation about, you know, what can you do to reduce the homeless in Sioux City? And one of the things that they brought up there was Native Americans actually comprise about 48% of the total pub and tox arrests here in town, which is kind of a big number. And they were looking for solutions, and one of the people there mentioned a restriction on canned beer, and that's kind of where it all started. And a handful of people met after that, including Frank Lemaire, who's a local Native activist out of Winnebago, Nebraska, which is about 30 minutes from Sioux City, and he met with the police chief and the sheriff here.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea? What is your gauge on how much support this possible ban has?
I can tell you it's controversial. As far as support, I think it's in the early stages of the conversation. I think trying to get support for this would be difficult here.
Opposition from retailers probably too.
Yeah, I would say you would get a lot of opposition from local retailers because, these are guys that are trying to still make a profit. And, there have been, ways to try and do this also in White Clay, Nebraska, which is, also near a Native American reservation. And it's also just difficult to do it just because here in Iowa, the regulation of liquor sales, that's something that the state controls.
Mm-hmm. So there has been an attempt at something similar in a Nebraska town, and it didn't happen, or did it?
It did not happen over there. Basically, White Clay, Nebraska, is near the an Indian reservation in South Dakota. And basically, it's within walking distance, and the public intoxication there is much more of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been working with, state legislatures. I know Governor Pete Ricketts even made a pledge a couple weeks ago to try and address those issues, but, they're still working on it. It's not to the, Sioux City's problem isn't to that magnitude, but some of the core things are kind of related to that as well.
I suppose it's even a question because it's the state that regulates liquor sales. Can towns then further regulate it?
Well, basically what Sioux City can do is they can look at the kinds of sales that they have, like some of the malt liquors that they offer, and they can impose some sort of restrictions on that. But as far as like an outright ban, that's probably going to get some friction from the state level government.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so where does this issue go from here?
Well, right now I think it probably, the people that I've talked to, they're going to have to keep on talking about this, especially with, nonprofits and the homeless shelters around here. To my knowledge, nothing has gone before the city, mm-hmm. but I know that the local leaders that I've talked to, including LeMaire and the police chief here in Sioux City, they're probably going to have at least another discussion about this. They've also talked about trying to reopen a treatment center here near the airport that used to help Native Americans back in the 80s or so. And they've kind of said, even though an alcohol ban on single cans may not be easy to pass, another option would be to educate people and provide treatment services for them because that would be likely easier to get off the ground.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is in the context of other solutions to the problems recognized in the Sioux City area of homelessness and alcohol addiction. Okay. Kirby Kaufman, thank you very much, Sioux City Journal reporter. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Our News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News continues. Coming up later in the hour, a conversation with a presidential candidate you've probably never heard of, Larry Lessig, actually a fascinating man. We'll hear from him a little bit later in the hour. And also two views of the 2016 presidential race from opposite ends of the political spectrum. Donna Redwing of One Iowa and Bob Vanderplaats. He's a Christian conservative activist. They'll be each of them giving us their different, very different perspectives on this election cycle. Woodward Academy is a residential facility for delinquent youth that's located in Woodward in Iowa. That's in central Iowa. And here's some of a music video that students and staff created recently. It's become quite popular on YouTube.
I woke up this morning and I went to brush my teeth. I looked in the mirror to remind me of me. I thought to myself that I gotta tell his speech. I got goals I gotta meet, and things that I could teach. This coming from the heart, I ain't even trying to preach. We've been on it from the start, now we on it like a leash. I was lonely for a part, now we caught it like a leash.
Well, to go along with this music video, Woodward is bathing in success on several different fronts. Joining us to tell us about Woodward, the Academy, and their recent successes, William Terry, a lead teacher at Woodward Academy in Woodward, Iowa. William, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Acquaint us with Woodward Academy. Who is there? What kind of facility is it?
Yeah, Woodward Academy, it's a residential treatment facility for male youth. And we deal with behaviors, redirecting delinquents for their negative behaviors, turning into positive, and just socially acceptable, you know, patterns by teaching, coaching, modeling, and also mentoring these young gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. So the students at your academy, for instance, what's a typical history that would have brought them there?
Usually not going to school, things maybe getting in trouble with the law, so for various reasons. So this is an opportunity for them to get a second chance to get reassimilated.
Okay, so these are kids 12 to 18 years old, and let's hear about some of their successes. We heard a little bit about the music video there, a rap video. We'll hear some of that and more of that in just a moment. But doing well in basketball this year?
Oh, yes, yes. We achieved much success with the making it to the state tournament, first program of this type to make it to the basketball, state basketball playoffs there. So we're very excited around campus. Our powerlifting team, which has for the past decade, has been national champions. And topping it off this year, we're able to send one of our students to represent for the United States to the Czech Republic to compete for the world championship.
So powerlifting, weightlifting is what we're talking about here.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the daily activities. What goes on at the academy on a day-to-day basis?
On a day-to-day basis, the students' schedule is regimented from the time they wake up until lights out. Of course, a lot of it is intel with the school day, with them getting school. But after that, they have extracurricular activities. They can participate in sports. They have therapy groups. So it's a lot jam-packed in on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few seconds left, but if you could put Woodward Academy's philosophy in a nutshell, how would you express it?
Well, basically, his philosophy is just getting them to a place where students can make significant positive changes in their lives.
Okay. It's very interesting. There's a video on YouTube that is sort of an introduction to your academy, uplifting to see that, and also this YouTube video there. Were you involved in this music video at all, William?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm in the video, but we have students that actually spearheaded the project, and it was used primarily for them to write and be creative and express themselves, and okay. Students really took off.
Let's hear a few more bars of that. William Terry, thank you, of Woodward Academy in Woodward, Iowa. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Be back in just a moment with more of News Buzz from Iowa Public Radio. It's River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Can't wait to see my nights on the football field. Everybody know about the nights and how we keep it real. Man, other school fans, they can't hang with us. We own the night and we own the stadium. We understand our behaviors like a loaded gun. So interventions now, son, we don't play with them. So our families back home can be proud, yes. A life full of hope, life full of progress. Just like David against Goliath, the K.
So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News on Fridays. We call it our News Buzz. Quick conversations about some news that we didn't get to otherwise during the week. Coming up, a conversation with a Democrat running for president you've probably never heard of, Larry Lessig. But first, Monday on this program, a recent conversation I had on stage in Des Moines before a live audience at the Des Moines Social Club, a civil dialogue. Is what it was called, between two prominent Iowans representing opposing viewpoints on the political spectrum here in Iowa. One Iowa Executive Director Donna Redwing, one of the participants on stage with me, representing the state's leading lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender organization, One Iowa, and also Bob Vanderplaats. He's president and CEO of the Christian conservative organization, The Family Leader. So the three of us on stage had a conversation Monday. We'll hear how they began their cordial relationship. They've been having coffee now for 2 years regularly. We'll find out what they've learned from those coffees together and how others can open civil dialogues with those with opposing viewpoints. Separate from that onstage interview, I spoke with each of them backstage before that event to get their thoughts on the 2016 presidential race so far. I started with Donna Redwing of One Iowa.
I've seen a lot of presidential races, and this is the most entertaining ever. I think I'll stop being entertained somewhere around November and get really serious about it.
Okay, entertaining, worthwhile, good for our democracy?
Well, I think democracy is, at its best, is a little messy. Lots of people are involved. I'm watching the GOP with great interest. I have no idea who will shake out and, you know, who will be the nominee. And I think I feel the same about the Democratic hopefuls. I think they're all capable of being president of these United States. I have no idea who will get the nominee nomination.
Is there a candidate who you feel best reflects the aspirations of your organization at this point?
I think right now any of the Democrats would. I think Bernie Sanders has ignited a movement that is really thrilling for all of us. Hillary Clinton certainly has come round on lots of issues that impact the LGBT community, and we're really appreciative of that. And I think O'Malley has just shown himself to be an extraordinary candidate. I think he's been a real surprise, and I certainly like him. One Iowa is a nonpartisan organization, but of course, you know, I'm sure our membership and our constituency is leaning a little more to the left than the right, but I certainly can't speak for anyone except myself.
Mm-hmm. Are there candidates out there you would say would work against the causes that you're fighting for, that you would least like to see in the White House?
We have been bird-dogging all of the candidates, asking them some questions. One is, should a business be allowed to fire someone simply because they're LGB or T? And we've had some interesting answers.
For instance?
Just a couple of weeks ago, Rand Paul, his response was surprisingly ridiculous. He started to say, you know, if you lose your job because you're LGBT, the world has changed. You can always get another one. And then he kept going on and on. And we were horrified, but kind of tickled because his answer was so ridiculous. We then were really surprised. Chris Christie, his responses to our questions were, you know, what a moderate Republican would respond. And we were pleased with that. Mm-hmm. We asked both Republicans and Democrats the questions. Democrats, for us at least, their answers are a little more acceptable.
What about the leaders in the GOP column right now, Donald Trump and Ben Carson?
Neither seems to be a friend of the LGBT community. Trump, I think, in the past has been. I think his responses to lots of questions around lots of issues have turned sharply to the right.
And quickly, list off the issues that are top priority for you and your organization.
Well, certainly for our organization, we care about maintaining the right to marry, and that seems to be a real issue for them.
You see that in danger still, even after the Supreme Court ruling?
Absolutely. The GOP is talking about activist judges. They're talking about changes in the Supreme Court. They're talking about a Republican president who can fill the courts with people who would oppose same-gender marriage. We certainly look at issues that impact the transgender community. And certainly bread-and-butter issues that we all care about. You know, do we have a job? Can we pay our bills? Are we safe? You know, what does our foreign policy look like? So I think, you know, for LGBT people, we care about the same things everyone else does. but we also want to live with equality and justice.
Mm-hmm. So we are less than 100 days away from the Iowa caucuses. You're making a face. Does that surprise you, or are you grateful that that day is finally coming?
I'm glad the day is coming. What I really hope for is that we can maintain some civility in this election cycle.
How is your organization trying to shape the race or the narrative of the race?
I think we try to shape the narrative of the race by continuing to talk about our issues, by putting a face and a voice to who LGBT people are, and to make sure that all of the candidates understand that we're watching, we're listening, and you know what? We vote.
Okay. Donna Redwing is One Iowa Executive Director. Thank you very much for this short conversation.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And now I'm speaking with Bob Vanderplaats. He's the president and CEO of the conservative Christian organization, The Family Leader, for his perspective on this very unusual, exciting 2016 race. Glad to speak with you, Bob.
Oh, glad to be here. And it is unusual, and it is exciting.
So what are your thoughts about this race up to this point?
We're in uncharted territory. And the reason I say that is, first of all, you have that many candidates. You know, 17, I think we're down to 15 now.
I think we're actually down to 10 maybe. Who knows?
Yeah,
it's hard to keep track.
But on the Republican side, you have Donald Trump, who's come in with this bigger-than-life personality and with large crowds and leading the polls for 100 days. And now you have an outsider candidate who's never held public office either, Ben Carson, who has a great life story. You know, rise in the top of the polls. And you have these other guys who are trying to fight for significance in the debate. So we're going to see how this fleshes out. Mm-hmm. But I remind our audience all the time, the people leading at the end of October typically aren't the same ones leading at the end of January. So just let the process play.
Mm-hmm. I think some polls have shown, correct me if I'm wrong, that Ben Carson is making headway among evangelical Christians in Iowa.
Well, he is. And we always knew that he would. He's a man of deep faith. He shares his faith very openly. I read at one point where he said, you know, I don't get that caught up into the religion, but I get very caught up into the relationship with Jesus Christ. And so and Ben's the kind of guy, a lot like Mike Huckabee, who he wears on people very well. The more you're around him, the more you like him, the more you want to see him. And that's a very good attribute if you're running for president.
Do you have a candidate at this point that the family leader is backing?
No, we do not.
Endorsing?
We're going to have a forum on November 20, and it'll be a roundtable Thanksgiving forum where we're asking them face-to-face to talk about themselves, not about the other guys, about what makes them up, what's their worldview. After that forum, our board will get together, and then we'll try to make a decision sometime in early December about who we're going to endorse.
Okay, and then we can expect that in early December. What issues, specific issues, are at the top of your organization's list?
Well, let me give you a broad spectrum. First of all, we're looking at the character of a person. You know, can we trust them? Do they have a consistency of convictions? What they say today, does it represent what they said in the past, or has there been some evolution? And if it's a good evolution, that's great. If it's conversion on the way to Des Moines, you know, we're skeptical of that. Conversions on the way to Damascus, we're okay with. But now to Des Moines, we're skeptical. But then we're wondering, are they competent? Can they actually do the job? I mean, are they ready to be president of the United States? There's a lot of men and women of character that just aren't that competent to be president. And finally, it would be the company that they keep. Who are they surrounding themselves with? Who's whispering in their ears? And so we look at that. And if we have several candidates check off those three C's, character, competency, and company, then we take a look at cash. You know, who's got the resources to really go the distance here?
Mm-hmm. Besides what you just mentioned, meeting all the candidates, the endorsement coming up, how else is your organization, The Family Leader, trying to shape this election season, the narrative?
Well, what we're doing is, I mean, we've had four regional leadership summits. We had one statewide leadership summit. We're having a presidential family forum, as I mentioned, on November 20. And we're engaging conversation on pro-family issues. Obviously, people think of life and they think of marriage. They think of religious liberty, yes. But we're also talking about foreign policy, the economy, the debt. Just we need leadership today, so the tenets of leadership. So it's kind of a full spectrum because all those things impact the family.
Mm-hmm. I didn't specify the party when we started this conversation. You haven't mentioned the Democrats. Are they just not on your radar? Do you want to speak to Democratic voters?
Yeah, we really do. And matter of fact, when we had our leadership summit, we did invite Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton at our leadership summit aims. Bernie Sanders actually responded to us, said he'd love to have been there. He said, but he had to be, I believe, at an event in Texas, which prevented him from being there. On this particular one, the way the FEC regulates things, we almost have to declare that, you know, what party are we going to do this with? And so we chose the Republican Party.
Okay. Bob Vanderplaats is president and CEO of the Christian organization, The Family Leader. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
A conversation I had with Bob Vanderplaats of The Family Leader. Before that, Donna Redwing, Executive Director of One Iowa, the state's leading LGBT organization. Views of the 2016 race from opposite ends of the political spectrum. Those were conversations I had a couple of days ago with them before an event that I joined them for at the Des Moines Social Club. On Monday, we'll listen back to that event. Bob and Donna will tell us about how they've been getting together over the past 2 years regularly for coffee to have a civil dialogue. So on Monday over the noon hour, we'll learn how they began their cordial relationship, unusual relationship, you could say, what they've learned from it, and how others can open civil dialogues with those with opposing viewpoints. It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we know the field of Democratic candidates vying for their party's nomination has been winnowed down to just three. But wait, actually, there is another Democratic candidate you may have never heard of. His name is Larry Lessig. He's a professor of law at Harvard University. He's in Iowa this week and joins me now. Professor Lessig, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is the focus of your campaign?
Well, I'm focused on something I think most Americans recognize, which is that our government is deeply corrupted and crippled. Our Congress is corrupted and crippled by the influence of money and the way in which we've allowed Congress to become this incredibly polarized, dysfunctional institution. And what I think we need to do is to focus a campaign on how we fix that, because all of the other things that the Democratic candidates are talking about, things I care deeply about, like dealing with the problem of the minimum wage or dealing with the problem of climate change or getting us Social Security that's actually secure, all of these things are impossible until we actually get a Congress that's free to lead rather than spending all of its time focused on its funders. So that's the focus of my campaign, to address this democratic failure, this failed institution first. And once we solve that problem, then we can turn to all the incredibly important problems we know we have to address.
I think a lot of Americans share your concern about some of the things we hear happening in Washington. How would you go about it, though? How would you reform our campaigns, our system of government?
Well, this is what's so surprising. Most people think this is a problem that's been created by the Supreme Court and that there's nothing we can do unless we amend the Constitution. But in fact, most of this problem could be solved by Congress passing legislation to change the way campaigns are funded and to reform the way it itself gets selected so it's not this completely partisan, polarized institution that can't actually function. And so what I've been pushing is recognition of how through what I call the Citizen Equality Act, we could restore a government that is not bending over backwards to worry about what a tiny fraction of the 1% who fund their campaigns care about, but instead was focused on what most Americans actually wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. So how would that funding look differently? If let's just suppose you could get this act passed through Congress.
Right. So the statute would change the way campaigns are funded by creating what you could think of as bottom-up public funding of campaigns, not like the presidential public funding, which was kind of top down. This would be a way to get to give people like vouchers, which they could use to give to congressmen, this is like a rebate on their taxes, to give them resources that they could then use to give the congressman, to help the congressman fund their campaign, so that candidates would not be focused on the big funders, but would instead be raising money from all of us and therefore be responsive to all of us in a way that they're just not now.
Larry Lessig, you were not included in the Democratic debate, the first one. There's one coming up on the grounds of weak poll numbers. Isn't that a valid reason not to include you?
Well, it is. But the problem is there's this catch-22 going on here. The rule says I have to have 1% in three polls 6 weeks before the debate. But because the Democratic Party has not recognized me as a candidate, most of the polls are not including my name. So last week, three polls were released. One of them included my name, and I qualified in that poll. The other two didn't include my name, so obviously I couldn't qualify in that poll. Mm-hmm. So the point we're trying to make is, you know, at a minimum, I need to be in the polls. And as Politico calculated when they just looked at the statistics, if in fact I had been in all the polls, based on the statistics, I would have qualified for the debate. So this is a hard thing for a non-politician to figure out how you get into this kind of race. And, you know, obviously I'm not a senator or not a billionaire. But we think under the basis of the principle of the rule, we should qualify to be in the debate.
So what do you have to do to be recognized by the Democratic Party as a candidate?
That's a great question. Again, if I were a former politician or a current politician, they take it for granted that they need to be included. But if you're not a politician, it's pretty hard because, you know, as a professor, once I start running for office, I have to give up my salary. I can't be paid by the campaign until just before the election. So there's a limited window that I have, given I'm not a billionaire, to actually go out and to make my case and to make this issue salient. I've been working as hard as I possibly can to do that. We think that the numbers, if in fact we were polled, would show that I qualified under the standard that they set. But they've been pretty studious in keeping me out. And not just from the debates. You know, I was very eager to come to the Jefferson Jackson dinner that was held here last weekend. And we worked hard to try to be able to be included in that. That's not a debate. But we were not invited to attend that either. So for an outsider, for a non-politician, it's not yet clear the Democratic Party is eager to welcome us in.
I understand you've raised more money as a candidate than recognized candidates, Lincoln Chafee and Jim Webb. Now they're out of the race, and also several Republicans. Where is your financial backing coming from?
Well, right. When I launched this, I said I would run if we could raise $1 million in less than 30 days. And we did. We met that goal and pledges and commitments. And that was more than two of the Democrats and five of the Republicans. And so that's what we thought would, you know, make people recognize this was a viable, vital campaign. There were close to 10,000 people who supported the campaign. And those 10,000 people were really committed to having a voice in this election that was trying to focus on this fundamental corruption of our government. And that's not an issue that, you know, either the Democrats or the Republicans are eager to get people to focus on. You saw how uncomfortable the Republicans were when Donald Trump raised this issue in the second debate, and he's consistently talked about the problem of super PACs and how that's corrupting our system. And nobody's comfortable about this in the political classes. So I thought we could, you know, establish credibility as a campaign by demonstrating there was this ground of support stronger than the support in other races. But that still has not been enough for the Democratic Party.
We have to go in just a minute, but I want to know, week by week, how are you deciding whether it's worth it to stay in the race, to commit your energy and the people that who are working for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the issue for us now is whether we can get into the second debate.
Are you still negotiating that? Is that a possibility? Because Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee are not there. There's certainly room on the stage.
Yeah, no, there's room. When you compare the Democrats to the Republicans last night, there's plenty of room. So, yeah, we're still talking to them about whether I would be included in the second debate. You know, I have no desire to continue beyond the point that it makes no sense to be in this. And if the Democrats won't, you know, allow this to be on the stage, then, you know, we have to think of other ways to get this message out there. Because what we know from our own internal polling, which confirms what many people have been finding recently, this issue is at the very top of what people care about. YouGov did a poll and they asked Democratic primary voters, say what the one thing, if you could only get one thing in the next administration, what should that one thing be? The number one thing picked by Democratic primary voters was ending this corrupt system for funding campaigns. So we know this issue is salient and important to Americans, and I've just got to find a way to have a venue to allow people to see there's a way to solve it and that there's a campaign that would solve it if, in fact, we were successful.
Professor Larry Lessig, a Democratic candidate for president who is in Iowa this week, a professor of law at Harvard Law School. Thank you very much, Professor Lessig.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Let's launch into the Halloween weekend with this spooky-sounding tune by an Iowa band that will be performing at an IPR Java Blend event I'll be hosting at 2 p.m. today. That's at the Java House in downtown Iowa City. This is Soul Phlegm with Noose of the Night.
Courage, the cowards, they did retreat. Grab you by the neck, throttle the sanity from your grasp. Tie you to the mast, storm won't take you. Loosen up your grasp, these fools.